Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Sweatman, and today we've got a review of the new A24 film, Zola. Sophie Barnes joins me for that conversation, and we round out our Technicolor marathon looking at The Red Shoes with Rance Collins back to help us break that one down. Stick around.
Hey, last month I went dancing at this cute spot in Florida where my roommate's girl made like 5 G's a night. Because of
my we just met yesterday and you already trying to take hoe trips together?
Be ready by 2.
Hi, bitch!
You want to hear a story about how me and this bitch fell out? It's kind of long, but it's full of suspense.
You want to go somewhere with me?
That's my place. Shut it so bad.
That was a bit of the trailer for Zola. It's the new film from A24, director Janixa Bravo, starring Taylor Page and Riley Keough. It's about a road trip gone bad, gone wrong, gets really wild and crazy, and it's very funny. It's very dark, and the interesting thing about it is it's based on tweets, based on a Twitter thread that went viral several years ago. We'll get into that a little more in the discussion with Sophie Barnes. Sophie was here before to talk about The Assistant back in the Best of 2020 series and came back again to talk Zola today. She's a filmmaker here in Central Arkansas, so I'm so happy to have her back on the podcast again today. Here is my discussion with Sophie Barnes about Zola. Welcome back to the podcast, Sophie Barnes. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing very well, and I'm so glad to have you back on. We talked about The Assistant last time, which I loved that discussion, and that was a great movie, so I'm glad to have you back again to talk about Zola.
Yes, sir. My favorite movie of the year, probably.
Nice. Okay, good. So, yeah, I watched it the other day and really liked it, and then I saw that you had posted about it, so I was like, I think we need to have Sophie back for this one.
I'm very into this movie.
Yeah, I really like it as well. So what is Zola? It's the new movie from A24. One of the unique things about it is it's based on a Twitter thread. I think it's probably the first movie I've ever seen. Maybe the only one that exists. I don't know. That's based
it
on
is
tweets.
The only one.
That's a new,
it's the only one.
newfangled thing. So the kind of the story behind that is back in 2015, I believe there was this long Twitter thread that Zola tweeted. And I remember hearing about it. Like, I think I saw the first few and I was like, oh, this is really long. I'll read this later. And then I never did. And then this came, they bought the rights to it and made this movie out of it. And I wondered how they would, like, how much of that they would kind of explain in the movie. And it's right there, like, as a title card at the beginning. It says, you know, on whatever date in 2015, Zola tweeted 148 tweets and tells this story. And some of the, there's a lot of voiceover from Zola's character. And some of the, like most of it, I think, is directly from the actual tweets. So this is, you know, ostensibly a true story. And basically the story is two women go on a road trip that goes bad. And one of the characters is a pimp. And that's kind of the very basic setup. I guess we can get into some of the details about it later. But what do you like so much about this movie, Sophie?
Well, I remember the tweets. Like, I remember when all of that happened. And since I was like, let's see, 2015, I was like going into senior year of high school. And I think when it happened, yeah, it was in October. So it was October of my senior year. And I remember my friend like sent me the link and I was just like super into this like new idea of like there being a like an almost like a novel on Twitter. Like, I thought that was so cool. And so I read all of them and I read them twice, actually. And I've read them again since then. And I actually read them last night again so I could get like the, cause I watched it twice this week. And then I decided to read the tweets again. And what I like so much about it is, and I guess what I like about both the tweets and the film is just like the newness of it. Like, it's very, it's like kind of uncharted territory, like you said. It's like a newfangled thing to have to have tweets be like the basis of whatever. But it's also like, I don't know, it's just like it's it's a new kind of like absurdism and like it has to do with the digital world, which I'm like, you know, I have like my crazy little Instagram that I like post whatever I want on, and I kind of like am like sort of exploring my like freedom on the internet a little bit. And this is something that Zola was 100% doing with this thread. And with this film, they're also sort of testing the boundaries in a lot of ways. So I just really love, and then I love Jenixa Bravo's style. Like I love her, her really like just like dark comedy, her her very specific visual style. She's like Wes Anderson, but like a little more like Americanized, maybe. Because Wes Anderson sort of deals with like opulence and like like European styles, European styles and stuff like that. I guess I'm thinking more of just like Grand Budapest, but I feel like Jenixa Bravo has this like symmetrical sort of, but it's like without being too clean. So it's like, so it still sort of has like a, it's like some dirty gritty symmetry, it's very cool. It's very cool. And I love the filter on the film too.
That's an interesting thing about it.
It's very, it's kind of makes it look, it makes it look more humid, more Floridian. I guess.
It's like a little hazy or something.
Yeah,
that's cool. Let me, are you a fan of Miranda July? Just out of curiosity.
Your
Instagram kind of reminds me of her Instagram a little bit.
I would say that her Instagram is an influence on my Instagram for sure.
Very much like the digital kind of meeting of digital and filmmaking. I think that's a cool thing. This is my first thing I've seen of Jenixa Bravo's films. I wanted to watch Lemon for a while. I've heard it's really good. So yeah, this is, you know, now I'm gonna watch that soon because I really, really like this. But yeah, it's interesting. It's pretty gritty, like in the storytelling too. Like it's almost, I want to compare it to like Jackie Brown or something, but it's ostensibly true. So there's like that layer to it. But then it's just so funny too, and like has this kind of wild sense of humor. It's you hear movies described as a wild ride. I think other movies wish they could be this wild of a ride. Like it's really, really all over the place and fun and unexpected. But yeah, on the digital side, there's so many interesting, like, so there's the voiceover that's like reading the tweets. Some of those are really funny, and then there's also there's like random like phone noises, like it sounds like a message being sent or a tweet being sent at certain moments when it's like, is someone using their phone in the film, or is this somehow like signaling like this is a tweeted moment? And it kind of plays with that in a way that I kind of want to revisit and look back into it. But yeah, there's really like a lot of digital stuff all over this film.
I think actually the a lot of the tweet, like the tweety like sounds are literally when she verbatim says something from the thread.
That makes sense.
Cause I went back and like kind of tracked it a little bit and yeah, it was a lot of like just using that to like signify this is an actual thing that was said.
I thought about reading the thread before watching. I was like, you know, I think I'll watch the movie first and then go back and read it. And so I did. And it's really faithful. Like it's almost verbatim. Like obviously a lot of it is word for word, but then the story, there's very few changes. There's like a few character name changes. And then you get a little more context at the end of the Twitter thread about like what happened later. And there's like a few small things that are different, but yeah, it's really interesting. Like to use that as the basis for a film script. But yeah, I think it really works. And I think it's a kind of an interesting experiment, but I don't know, saying experimental makes you think like, oh, this maybe isn't that good, but we'll forgive it for being experimental. But no, it really is that good too. Like, I don't want to downplay how good it is by saying that it's kind of doing some risky things, but yeah.
I'm really into, I wouldn't call it like experimental necessarily. I mean, I think more so it's just like delving into surrealism. And so there's moments that seem like an experiment, but it's like sort of like classic surrealist, like sort of like the dry, like, I don't know. There's just moments throughout that I was like, that is 100% just Jenixa Bravo's sense of humor. Like she just thinks that's hilarious. that something like that. And I don't know, like, there were moments where I was like, do I like that? And then I was like, actually I do, because it's like all blending in with the same, like it's the same thing. Like it's consistent throughout the whole film.
Yeah.
Like it's not trying to be, you know what I like about this movie? It's not trying to be the like blockbuster that like James Franco would have tried to make this movie into, you know, and James Franco was originally going to make this movie.
I didn't know that. Wow.
And he wasn't the right choice whatsoever when you, especially when you look at what the final product of this film is. Mm-hmm. Janixa Bravo is the perfect director for this because she is so stupid at times. Like, she has the stupidest humor and I love it so much. Like, her Instagram makes me laugh so hard. She has so many like little bits and she's just like almost like she has like a comedy Instagram. She's just like has the stupidest humor, but also she's dealing with like a really traumatic and tragic situation of just like losing trust with somebody that you thought you like were friends with. And just she has the perfect sort of like combination of like just like grace and style and everything. And it's just not trying to be this like blockbuster, you know, it's like, it's just a little movie, you know, when you watch it, it really is a little movie. Like, it's very quick. It goes by very quickly. It's an hour and 30 minutes. And it's like, it's just bite sized sort of, you know, like I wanted more. I wanted a lot more, especially of all the little, like, I don't know, like the mirror sequences and the little like brain worm that she like that she starts like going into her head, like because she's like fully just having an out of body experience because of what's going on around her.
Yeah.
And she just sees like a little like star worm like thing in her head. Yeah. I love that. I love that type of thing. That's like totally something I would do in a movie. And I think this movie, I don't know. Like, I don't know if you had something else planned for this direction
for
this conversation. I'm just thinking about how much I love the way that Zola is presented, like the way Taylor Page plays this character is wonderful. Like, it's like, I think I read several reviews that were like, her eyes are just like, her eyes are like the most actorly eyes ever. Like, she just knows how to use them and she knows how to like signal things with her eyes. And it's just like, she's just like perfect for this role. And then I also think Riley Keough is really great. And it's like, it's like a stupid movie in a way. And I love that. Like, but it's not stupid at all. Cause it's so important to like be talking about like how like people of color handle situations where white people are fucking insane. Yeah. I'm sorry. I just cursed. But like, it's really important to talk about that. Cause then that sort of like, it should be the like focus. It is the focus of this story of like Zola went on Twitter and like therapeutically like tweeted out and got like, she went viral and made the story less like scary. Yeah. It made it more like funny and relatable, even if it's not remotely relatable because of the way that she presented it. And she didn't try to be anybody but herself, you know.
Yeah.
You know, being a woman of color who is also like a writer and she's funny and all this stuff. She's just being herself with this thread and in the film, I think Taylor Page does a really good job.
Yeah, kind of showcasing that. Yeah,
I
think you're right. And it's what you're saying about like the humor and like the kind of the intersection of trauma and humor maybe is a unique thing, because some of the funniest moments in this are also some of the darkest moments. Like, it really finds humor in those things. And yeah, I think you're right. Like, it kind of makes it less scary. There are some moments that are dark and are not funny in this movie too, and I think it kind of knows when to when to play that for laughs and when to not. But yeah, I really think it's really strong. Yeah, Taylor Page is fantastic in this. Like what you're saying about her eyes, some of the like funniest moments from her, she's using very little words and it's all in her body language and like her tone and stuff. So I'm thinking about when she gets in the car with the boyfriend character and he's like trying to talk to her and she's just being really short with him. Like, that made me laugh so hard. that was a really great moment.
Yeah. I know so many of those dudes too. I knew so many of those like goofy white dudes who are so like, they think they're hilarious and they think what they like watch online and see online, like their meme taste is hilarious, but they're really so stupid. And that's like all I deal with in Arkansas in a lot of ways, but like a little bit less like 2015 and like, like, I guess it's like a different vibe, but like goofy ass white dudes there. they need to be put to shame. Goodbye.
Yeah. Let's talk about the performances. Cause I'm trying to remember who plays Derek is the boyfriend named Nicholas Braun. He's very funny in this. Like, and I think all the performances are like really kind of low key and like in a way that they're really just embodying these people. I don't think this movie works half as well if we don't have excellent performances, and we do like pretty much across the board, I think.
Yes.
So like he's not the one I want to praise the most, but he is really good. But yeah, Taylor Page is fantastic. I think Riley Keough is really, really great. And her, like Riley Keough as Stephanie, like does a kind of a big swing as far as the voice and the accent goes.
Yeah.
And it's really funny. And I think it works too. Yeah, she's great at
this. Have you seen the film American Honey?
I have not, but it's been on my list for a long time.
Okay. So Riley Keough's in that movie and she does like a Southern accent. So it's not a black scent, but it's like, it's still like sort of in that line and she like kind of seems like she's from Florida and she wears like Confederate flag, like a Confederate flag bikini in it. It's, I think maybe, I don't remember. But yeah, she's not far off honestly from that role in this one. It's just, it's a little bit more intense, but like seeing Broad American Honey, it makes sense why she was cast in this film. It's probably her role in American Honey probably had a lot to do with why she was cast in this film, actually, because of the like just the nature of both characters. They're both like really mean like white girls, but one of them is just a little bit silly, maybe a lot of bit sillier, and just stupider. I love that scene where they're talking in the car right outside of the first motel when they get there, and she like puts her lipstick on. She goes, "You know, they filmed in Miami Vice here," and her boyfriend's like, "Yeah, I don't remember that." And he's like, he goes, "Oh, those lips," and she's like, "Oh, they're not too pink." And he goes, "I want to lick them." And she's like, "Chill." I thought that was so funny.
Yeah, there's so many good back and forths like that in this. Yeah.
I think that also has to do with just Janixa Bravo and Jeremy O'Harris as a writing team. And then Zola on top of it. Like, all three of these people have their own unique styles, their own unique storytelling styles. And Zola's like the spearhead, and then Jeremy O'Harris and Janixa Bravo are two different writers, and like, but they both deal with like really dark themes. They deal with sexuality and like surrealism and like understanding like modern like interpretations of things and like what's going on in modern society in terms of like I mean, Lemon deals with like a modern day like white dude, and then one of Jeremy O'Harris's acclaimed plays, Slave Play, deals with like classic interracial roles. Or like not interracial, not classic, but interracial relationships, but in like the context of like master slave like settings and stuff like that. And it's like very like on the nose, and like, but it's also like, it's a really, really like sort of raw exploration of like interracial relationships and sexuality in the modern age and all this stuff. And so I think all of them together are helping to make like this film, like they're all hilarious.
Yeah.
But they're all also like very refined, like voices, like black voices particularly. And so like the team work between the three is really like, it's cool to see.
Yeah. So, like, I'm not that familiar with Jeremy O'Harris or Denise Bravo's writing prior to this, but it sounds like a perfect kind of trifecta, bringing them in with Zola to create this. So yeah, that's really cool. As far as performances, the only other thing I wanted to mention is Colman Domingo is, I really, really like him and all the things I've seen him in. And he's really good. I haven't seen him be like menacing and scary before. And he is in this, like he's a monster in this, but yeah, it's a really good performance from him. I first saw him in, If Beale Street Could Talk, and like, at least that's when I first kind of took note of him. And he's like a really loving father figure in that. And he's so great. And then he's in, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom last year, but he's in a lot of stuff, but I really, really like him. So I didn't realize he was in this actually when he came. I was like, oh my gosh, we got Colman Domingo in this. So yes, really great. The kind of primary two, Taylor Page and Riley Keough, were fantastic. And then kind of rounded out with him and Nicholas Braun. I think the central four in this really are wonderfully performed.
I agree. And I think if I were to say anything that's like not just like insanely high praise about this film, it's sometimes like the second time I watched it, I was like, maybe I want this to be a little bit more like a little bit more intense. Like I kind of wanted it to get, but also like in the tweets, you don't really get the sense that she was like, I mean, I think you get the sense that she feels like she could have died, but I think it's more that it's just like really like shocking and like, like traumatic for her to think that she's going on this trip to just go dancing and then to realize that there's all this stuff like to do with Stephanie and her pimp and everything. I think that it's, like, I think that it could have been more intense in the film, but maybe that was just me. And like, I really, I don't know. Like,
yeah, I think I see what you mean. Cause it's, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh no. I was just going to say X read as, and maybe it's just Colman Domingo also is like a very like heartwarming person
it's
to
hard
me.
To dislike
like,
him. Yeah.
He's a really, like, I love everything he's in the sense that he's usually cast as like a good person or something. And so like, it was hard for me to like see him as evil. And then at the end, he sort of like saves everyone. He's like, kind of like saves the girls from the dude ish. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Like it's a little like iffy on whether I thought he was like really like the best villain, but he's an amazing actor. And he is really scary in parts. Like maybe I just read this Twitter thread so many times and I know the whole story. And like, I saw it once and I saw it again and just kind of, I think it's like, I love this movie and I'm very passionate about it and I'll go to my grave saying it's great. But I think maybe I'm like, the story is so brief and it doesn't have quite as many twists and turns as maybe like you would expect out of like a crazy story, but it does have a lot. And it's like, it's really scary at times, but it's also kind of like ends and you're like, oh, okay, that's the end. Yeah. But it sort of ends abruptly. It's like somebody dies and then boom, we're gone. It's out. Yeah. I mean, I feel like this is how it went in real life. So, I mean, you work with what you have. And then they also like, they sort of did like, take things and change them a bit in the script just because of cinematic, like just the quality of the moment wasn't quite as cinematic as it needed to be or something like that. I think though, outside of all of that, Colman Domingo is still great in the film. And then I thought Nicholas Braun was really funny,
yeah.
But he was so similar to a Succession character, kind of.
Oh, really? Interesting.
I feel like he's similar to a Succession character in that, which is fine. Like it's sort of like all of them have played maybe similar roles, in like a very general way before, but these roles are very specific. And I think it's like a all-star cast. Like you said, it's a really well cast film. I also thought the guy who Derek
befriends at the
hotel. I thought he was hilarious. Yeah, I thought he was really funny. He said, y'all need to stop getting delusions of gander. That was so funny.
That's Jason Mitchell. He plays Dion. Yeah. I'm looking at the casting now. Yeah, he's very, very funny. yeah, and I see what you mean about Coleman Domingo. It's because he is so likable. I think he's never like super menacing like that. Like, I don't know. I get like the characters are afraid of him when he talks about this in the tweets too. Like his African accent comes out when he's really angry. That happens in the film too. Yeah, I think he's so likable that it's like it is a little jarring when he kind of goes, gets mad and like goes for that menacing thing. That I see what you mean. Like maybe it doesn't totally, totally mesh. But I think it is an interesting juxtaposition because like even in his his job, he needs to be likable for things to go, but also like be a little scary. So I don't know. I think I'm glad he's in it, but I see what you mean about it.
Yeah.
Do you have, I guess we haven't really talked about that many specifics of the plot, but I guess basically they go on this road trip to go to strip clubs and dance and make a lot of money in a few days. And it turns out that Coleman Domingo's character is planning to prostitute them.
Mm-hmm.
And then Zola kind of refuses to do that, but then kind of takes on a pimp role herself in a way that she's like kind of forced to in a way. It's really kind of interesting and is successful at that. And then the dynamics of that kind of go all over the place. And then there are some surprises. Do you have any like favorite moments from the film you wanted to mention?
Actually, my favorite part of the whole movie is when they go to the room. And then just from that point on, when X leaves, like when she yells at Stephanie, when Zola yells at Stephanie, and then the dude comes and there's that whole thing. And then Mika Levy's score is insane at that point.
Yeah.
Like it gets really, really good. Like I was listening to it last night. So the song called A Mess is what plays over the plays over that like first scene with the first client who comes in. God, I love Mika Levy. Like I'm a big fan of Mika Levy. I love the score for Jackie and Under the Skin.
That one's incredible too.
Yes. And then Mika Levy also did something else recently. I think I can't remember what it was. But
I'll try and pull that up real quick.
I'm not sure. Anyway, I also liked how the score has a lot of the same like words and like phrasing from the thread that may not have been in the film. Like when Zola says they start fucking, it was gross. Like that's like what she says in that scene. But there's other ways that she describes that in the thread in the score, like sort of pays homage to those like phrasings,
cool.
Which is like a funny little thing. But my favorite moment is when it transitions to her, like that happens when the first client comes. And then she's like, pussy's worth thousands. And then and then she's just like setting her up and like taking pictures and all that stuff. I love the score at that moment. I just think it's really great. And I love when they're like the scrolling through. I thought all the little like sort of editing moves or like, I don't know, like little things to make you feel like you're in a digital, more in a digital environment or more like you're inside of a phone. I liked that. So that was my favorite moment. I think other than that, I loved all the wide shots of them, like going from place to place, like when they're running away at the end. I loved that, like by the pool where there's the little person. And he says, I don't even know what he says, but I just
it's
thought
just perfect
it was so,
in that little moment. It's,
it's
so
exactly
weird.
That's Jenixa Bravo's humor. That's exactly that is her type of thing. Just to put some random thing in that's just like stupid and funny.
It's a perfect little like punctuation on that tense scene, like this funny little quip that he says. I can't remember what it is either, but yeah, it's so funny.
It is funny. Yeah, you know, it's I think it's a perfect, like, every time something gets a little intense, it gets funny, which I think is the point of this movie. Like, this woman dealt with her pain and trauma like through humor, and this film doesn't linger on bad things, and that's, you know, that's why it can't be as intense as maybe I want it to be, because it's like it has to be like funny, because it has to stay true to what Zola was literally doing with the thread, which was to make light of the situation in order to be, you know, make it like sort of have catharsis with it. I love the score so much too. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I was
going to
talk about the score too.
Yeah.
The even like the opening, it's got like them in this kind of dreamlike mirror room and they're doing their makeup, and there's like a lot of harp. You don't hear a lot of harp in scores like these days, but it's got this interesting harp kind of thing happening. And then the score is just really a strong part of this. I think as far as favorite moments for me, it's early on when they are kind of first meeting. I think it's maybe right before the opening credits, but like they meet at this restaurant. In the tweets it says it's a Hooters, I believe, and where Zola's working. And then like Stephanie comes in, and there's the shot where they're like face to face, and it's like the shot you're seeing around on the internet around this movie. But they're in the restaurant, and then the lights go out one by one, and then it flashes in there like in this hall of mirrors or whatever that space is, and it but they're in the same place, and there's a lot of good little touches like that. And I think that was a cool way to like say, oh, this is the kind of movie this is going to be, and got some visually interesting things happening. So I really like that. One of the asides that's just so funny, I'm not gonna like quote it or anything, because I mean, for a variety of reasons, I shouldn't, but there's a prayer scene that really, really made me laugh when they're just getting to the club in Florida. And like the strippers are praying about the night, and that made me laugh so hard.
Oh, goodness. T.S. Madison was really funny, and she was in it so briefly, and I really wanted a little bit more of her, but it was so funny. That was like a perfect little like moment.
Brief little
moment on screen, but it was so funny.
So that one's so great. And then I think one of my it's one of the voiceover tweets that are describing what's happening, and it's at the end, so I won't tell exactly what happens, but something crazy happens, and then Zola's tweet says, "Swear to God, Bible," and like this thing happened. Just like the delivery of that is so funny to me.
So funny. No, and that's what she tweeted.
Yeah,
and
she
was so funny. I wish there were more of the moments in the tweets where she's like, "Whoa!" Like she's. I mean, like that just like that could have translated a little differently on screen. I think maybe like just more like, I don't know. I feel like some of it was Zola was both disgusted and like in a way amused. Like, this is absolutely insane. What's happening to me right now? This is not at all what I expected to happen. And yeah, I think that it could have been a little more like, what the fuck? but also it still was like, I don't know. I think they chilled out on that in lieu of like a like being disgusted or like just like uncomfortable with the situation, which is 100% valid. And I also know that Zola was deeply uncomfortable in these situations.
Yeah, that's one of those things that's like, this is really dark, but it's also funny in the way it's being presented, but it's also true in a way. So it's really complicated, I think, in kind of all those layers of it. But yeah, and that is a really funny one. And then, what was I going to mention? One other thing I'm forgetting now. But yeah, lots of good surprising things in this movie. So funny. Taylor Page is incredible.
I know.
Do we need to say anything else about this movie before we wrap up?
I wanted to say one more thing. I don't know if, like, okay, so I came in just like a couple minutes behind on the first time seeing it, and so I came in right when they were like talking, and she was saying, "You dance," basically the moment you mentioned is when I came in, and I. Like, I kind of was like, is this like queer undertones a little bit?
I had the same feeling. Yeah.
I truly, like, at the beginning, like, it was sort of like they were like, sort of, they liked each other and they were like, they like were talking to each other and they were like vibing. And I loved the part where they sort of did the little subtitles. They said, "I feel seen," and "I'm like, I feel heard by you," or something like that. And I was like, this would be wonderful. Like, this could be a wonderful little, like, love story, but it's not that. And that's, like, but I love the, like, sort of queer undertones at the beginning and at the end, because Stephanie's, like, looking back at Zola lovingly in the car as they're driving away. And she goes, "You know, I love you, bitch." And Zola just, like, looks away from her, and it's sort of like a rejection.
Yeah.
And I like that. I mean, it wasn't like too intense, because that's not what the story's about. But it's like, it was sort of like about, like, girls, like, falling in love with each other a little bit, and then like the betrayal that comes when one of them's not telling the full truth and everything. Just like any relationship.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's kind of all I had.
No, I was going to say the same thing. I wasn't sure if I should bring that up, because I don't want to, if I'm reading that incorrectly, then it's weird for me to say, but I felt the same way. Like, I was like, are they attracted to each other a little bit? And, like, I think that would make sense of, like, why they just met and Zola's, like, willing to go on this trip, because it's, you know, we just met, like, yesterday or whatever, and you want to go on a trip together. And she even expresses, you know, you want to go on hoe trips already or whatever. But if there's some attraction there, that kind of makes sense of it. And, yeah, I think that adds a layer at the end, too, that I hadn't actually thought about. But, yeah, absolutely. And I remember the other – I was going to mention the subtitles moment, too, because I think that's a really brilliant thing that they do to kind of draw us into and just kind of, like – the way these two characters communicate may be very different than most viewers communicate. And so just a little bit of, like, here's the subtext here. Like, there's more, I think if they had done that the whole time, it could have, like, been a problem. Right. But doing it just wants to kind of, like, get you on the movie's wavelength a little bit or something. I thought it was a really nice touch.
I agree. And it just, like, it just made my little queer heart, like, flutter a little bit. I was like, oh my God, are they going to be a little gay? It was, like, nice. But yeah, I thought it was just wonderful. Like, the whole opening of that film is just, it's just great. Like, it's perfectly rhythmic, and it's like, it hits all the notes that you want it to hit. It hits the comedy, it hits the little, like, sweet, almost like romantic vibes. And then I love when she's like, "I gotta go fuck my man calm." And then,
which is from the tweets too.
Like, I liked that little moment that they had. And I just thought all the performances and everything about all the editing and just everything about this film was so natural. Like, it was really, it, like, sort of bloomed organically, and it wasn't like, and nothing was forced, I felt. I'm really proud. I'm really proud to say that I've been excited about this movie for so long. Like, since I found out that the rights were optioned for this particular Twitter thread, I have been, like, waiting for this movie, just, like, on the edge of my seat, waiting to see it. And I'm really glad that we got this surrealist, like, almost queer, like, just wacky thing. Yeah, like,
weird, it's little movie.
It is so wacky and, like, eclectic, and just, like, it's a lot of stuff thrown together that works really well, and it's purposefully, like, it's calculatedly so. And I'm just, it's a perfect, like, it's a perfect team for this movie. So why wouldn't it be a really great movie?
Yeah. Really turned out good. Highly recommended from both of us, as you can tell. so that is playing in theaters now. And I wasn't sure how wide of a release it was going to get, but I think it's playing in like multiple places here in Central Arkansas. So it must be all over the place. So go see Zola. That is the new A24 film. Thank you so much, Sophie, for coming on the show today.
Of course.
Well, all right. We'll have you back again sometime. I'll be in touch for that. But until then, we will say bye-bye for now.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Big, big thanks to Sophie for coming on the podcast to talk about Zola today. I was planning to review that one solo, and it's always better when there's a second voice. So I'm so glad she was able to come on the show and give her many thoughts about the film. Next up, we are moving back to our Technicolor marathon. This is the final of our three films before we did The Adventures of Robin Hood and then Leave Her to Heaven, rounding out with the Powell and Pressburger classic, The Red Shoes. This is a ballet movie made in Technicolor, of course, and widely considered their masterpiece and probably one of the best ballet movies ever made. Rance Collins is back to finish out the marathon. I'm so glad we've taken the time to look at all these Technicolor films and appreciate the place that Technicolor has in cinema history. Rance is the perfect person, of course, to break this all down because he is the host of his own podcast, The Envelope Please, which is all about classic cinema and Oscars history. And if you've never heard an episode with him before, he has worked for Turner Classic Movies. He just knows everything about classic films. So always glad to have Rance back. And he's been so gracious to do several episodes in a row here. So thank you to Rance. Without further ado, here is my discussion with Rance Collins about The Red Shoes.
Shoes. Daringly original musical that captures all the glamour of the south of France in exquisite technicolor, blending compelling beauty and high drama with a love story of sheer enchantment, assembling a cast of international stars to endow an enthralling film with their rich vitality, and making the outstanding debut of this or any other year, a lovely red-headed girl graced with all the talents, Moira Shearer.
Rance Collins, welcome back once again. How's it going?
It is going so good. How are you?
I'm doing very, very well. Yes. Excited to finish out our Technicolor marathon looking at The Red Shoes today. It's been enlightening to visit some films I might not have otherwise, you know, which is the best thing about doing a podcast, I think. So, yes.
Yeah, thanks for me too, honestly, because I hadn't seen this one before this week.
It was your first time, right? Yeah.
It's my first time, so you helped me discover something had heard about for a long time, but had not had a chance to see.
Yeah, this has been one that I've been wanting to watch, and knew it was in Technicolor, and so all three of these were new to me that we did with Robin Hood and then Leave Her to Heaven. But so this one was new to both of us. So let's talk about The Red Shoes. Kind of broad strokes plot. It came out in 1948, directed by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, who they were a pretty big directing duo that, again, like, I'd heard of Powell and Pressburger, but this is actually my first film of theirs to see as well. So good introduction for that as well. So the story is, it's about a ballet company. So there's a lot of behind the scenes show business kind of stuff, but kind of in the world of ballet, which is not something I'm used to seeing. So it was kind of enlightening in that way. The company is run by Mr. Lermontov, who's kind of an eccentric, stern, artistic type of guy. And at the start of the movie, a new dancer joins the company. That's Vicky, Victoria Page. And she quickly rises to be kind of the star dancer of the company. And then there's also a new composer. His name is Julian Craster. And they kind of enter in interesting ways. There's like a whole interesting introduction to both of them. Then they eventually work on a new ballet, which is called The Red Shoes, which is based on a Hans Christian Andersen story. And then about two-thirds through the film, we see a performance of it, and that there's like this really extended ballet sequence. There's a few other ballet sequences as well in the film. So that's, it kind of works towards that. And then where things go kind of near the end is that there's also a love story between Victoria and Julian, and then she's kind of torn between dancing and being in love. So that's kind of the overall setup of it. And it's really an interesting movie in a lot of different ways. So as a first time viewer of this rant, what's your reaction to it? Did you like it?
You know, I did. I did really like it. I didn't know. I kind of had an idea of what I might expect with this movie. Mm-hmm. From having seen scenes and clips from it before, but I think it exceeded my expectations, actually.
Yeah.
It was, I don't know. You hear that it's like a dance movie. And so you have a certain perception of what you're going to get into, but I feel like, it went a little beyond, it's an art movie.
Yeah. And so you mean like more than maybe dancing? Like there's a lot of non-dancing scenes. Is that what you mean?
There's a lot of non-dancing scenes, but the dancing scenes in general are nothing like, it's just of its own genre almost.
Yeah. I think that's what you mean. So you know? Maybe you're getting at, so like the big ballet sequence, it's staged in a way that it could never actually be staged in person. If you're watching a ballet, it like brings in the cinematic language to it in a way that's really creative. And it was one of my favorite things. And probably that ballet sequence is my favorite part of this whole thing. It's really an amazing sequence. Like there's, you know, characters disappearing and like things like that could only happen in a movie. I think as far as ballet movies, it's one of, there's not that many. And this is, I think, kind of considered the best ballet movie ever. I feel like I learned a lot about how ballet worked and how ballet companies worked at that time.
It was, beyond like how ballet companies and whatnot worked, I think that the movie feels like it feels like a culmination of different types of expressionistic art, that makes sense. I think it pulls in some of the German expressionism movement that was really big in the silent era. It pulls in some of the like Salvador Dali type of
surrealism.
Yeah. Which is present a little bit in a movie that came out a couple of years before this called Spellbound, the Hitchcock movie Spellbound, where Salvador Dali did a dream sequence in the film that was heavily edited and is much shorter in the final print. But this movie like commits to making its story basically a metaphor for the ballet within the story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and it does so in a way that does not shy away from being surrealistic, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's an interesting part of it. So like the meta narrative maybe of, so the story of the red shoes is that once you have the shoes on, you can't take them off and you can't stop dancing. Like that's the fairy tale of it. And that mirrors what happens in real life to Victoria in some interesting ways. I think that's it's a really nice touch to build it in that way.
It is. It's a really, like all those people are right. It's a great movie and it has been, given plenty of accolades over the years. I mean, it is one of the top 100 British films of all time, according to the British Film Institute, I believe is the one who put together that list. I think one of the reasons why it kind of rises above is there isn't anyone in the film who is particularly famous, you know. It is a cast largely made of real ballet performers. And as such, it ends up kind of, what's the word I'm looking for here? It ends up kind of being better because you're not rooting for Cary Grant or Deborah Carr, you know, it ends up being
star power.
Star power isn't isn't a factor in this movie. Mm-hmm. And that does, I think, make it something better, something different.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it'd be very easy to... I mean, like, you could have casted some actress in that role who would have been more recognizable yeah. to international audiences. And you probably would have had to... dance, cut around her dancing, because right. she probably wouldn't have been up to snuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it would have, you know, then you would have had like so and so in this, and that's what most studios would have done at that time. But mm-hmm. I think because it was this very respected directing writing team, known together as the Archers, mm-hmm. Powell and Pressburger, you know, and it was produced in England, they could get away without having huge names in the cast. And as such, you end up making something that feels like it's totally of its own. Mm-hmm. And it's completely unencumbered by anybody who might outshine the art with their own fame.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was unfamiliar with anyone in this movie. I think I'd heard the name Maura Shearer. Who's the lead is Victoria, but she was like a famous ballet dancer at the time, and I watched a couple of special features on the Criterion. I got the Criterion DVD from the library, and
fun.
There's like her ballet directors didn't want to let her do it at first, and there was kind of some hesitance there, like if she goes and does this film thing, is she going to leave ballet behind? And then ultimately they said, you know what, this will probably be good for ballet overall, like it'll increase the love of ballet, so let's let her do it. And then of course it was huge and, you know, Oscar nominated and all that, so probably a good decision on their part.
I would say it was a very good decision. Yes. And certainly, like, if for her, if, you know, a ballet star is only famous for a finite period of time, right. if mm-hmm. live performance is all they're doing, because, you know, there's nothing, there's not much recorded of that. Yeah. But I think that, you know, being in this, I mean, definitely cemented her as a legend.
Mm.
Yeah.
let's talk about Powell and Pressburger. So this is not their first film. Actually, it was like, what, their 10th or something, I think. What are they known for otherwise?
They had a pretty incredible run in the 1940s. I have been pretty familiar with their work. Over the last few years, I have tried to seek out any of their films that I could find to watch, particularly if it's playing in a movie theater here around LA,
yeah.
because they just have a uniquely great run of collaborations. They started working together in the early 40s after Powell, I believe it's Powell. Is it Powell or Pressburger? Now I'm getting them.
Oh. Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger.
I know their names.
Oh, okay.
One of them worked with Alexander Korda.
Oh, I see.
For many years. And I want to make sure that I get the right person. I'm like,
that was
going
Powell.
To stall.
Yes, that was Powell.
Yes, it's Powell.
According to Wikipedia.
The two of them worked together. They did some projects that were very, very successful, including The Thief of Baghdad, which was another big Technicolor movie that really incorporated a lot of very innovative special effects. It got attention here in the United States and won an Oscar for its special effects. He paired with Powell. He made a movie called The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, which is a great epic film that introduced the world to Deborah Carr, was her first big movie. And I saw a screening here at the Academy Theater here in LA of that movie. And it was just, it's like 2.5 hours or so, but it was just such an engaging, wonderful, funny, dramatic film. And then they made this incredible movie called A Matter of Life and Death. But all of these are not all of the movies they did together, but they are known for their use of Technicolor, and they made several great Technicolor films. Life and Death of Colonel Blimp is in Technicolor, and then A Matter of Life and Death, which I believe was released as Stairway to Heaven in the United States. It uses Technicolor in a really interesting way. David Niven is the star of that movie, and then Kim Hunter, who is best known for Streetcar Named Desire. The two of them star in that, and heaven in the film is presented in black and white, and reality is in color, and reality is where the lead character wants to be, but he was supposed to be taken away, and like you know, the Grim Reaper type of character missed him, and so now he's bartering with death to stay on Earth. And anytime he's in heaven, it's in black and white because it's where he doesn't want to be.
How interesting. Know? Yeah.
Yeah. There's also a really small role in that movie by from a very young Richard Attenborough.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Who becomes, you know, of course, the guy who welcomes you to Jurassic Park.
Yes.
And then directed Gandhi. After that, they made their final two collaborations that were released through the studio. I forget the name of the production company. You know, I don't know my British companies as well as I do my American studios. I'm very, very, very sorry to your English listeners. The culmination of their projects together were this movie, which came out second, and the first movie to come out before this of these two movies. I'm saying this in a weird way. It's fine.
I'm tracking.
Was Black Narcissus.
Black Narcissus.
And both of them have a surrealist quality about them. Both of them deal with psychological drama and conflict, and they both have just the most incredible use of color. And so leading into The Red Shoes, this team, Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, had become just the preeminent filmmakers in the UK. And ultimately, this movie would end up being incredibly successful, perhaps even more successful here in the States than it was in England. It became the highest grossing British film up to that point. And it also got 5 Academy Award nominations, including one for Best Picture, at a time when foreign films, even British films, typically didn't do a lot over here, you know. It was very Hollywood centric at that point in time. So and if it wasn't a Hollywood A picture, then it at least needed to have, you know, like a Laurence Olivier in it. And in this case, it was just sheerly the quality of the film that moved it along. And I think that a lot of it also had to do with the fact that I don't think anything like this had been made up to that point.
From what I was, you know, seeing on the Criterion stuff and reading, is like, I think it's kind of the first ballet movie. Like, really, there's not much before this that had anything to do with ballet. And again, there's not just a ton of ballet movies still, but the only other one that I could think of that I'd seen was Black Swan from a few years ago, the Darren Aronofsky film, which you can see a lot of influence of The Red Shoes on that film. Like a big time, actually. It's like a much more psychologically thrilling kind of horror version of this story, almost, where someone's kind of caught between dancing and maybe is losing their mind a little bit, kind of thing. So yeah, I thought that was a fun connection to it, but you can definitely see how this was influential to things going forward.
For sure. I think that I think you can see the thread, and the thread doesn't necessarily have to be going into other ballet movies, obviously. But I think I think the use of photography, the use of color in this movie, I wonder if there's even a movie after this that uses color as well as this movie does. Because talking about the technicolor aspects of it, you know, particularly in the dream sequence, but even just its location photography in Monte Carlo. And the way that it puts in the reds and the greens and the, you know, all of the color palette represented in a way that seems to be expressing something about the turmoil that's going on inside of Vicky's head. You know, is it's just so original, and it feels like there were certain shots, particularly in the ballet sequence, that I was thinking, I was in awe as I was watching it. And I was just thinking, there's nothing like this that exists. You know, this is completely of its own.
It's so original. And it's,
And I don't think of myself as a person who's going to enjoy ballet movies. And yet,
same.
And yet somehow this doesn't even feel like it's totally about ballet. It's just about, it felt like a fable.
Yeah, the Hans Christian Andersen-ness of it, it really kind of carries over into the off the stage stuff too in the film.
I was thinking that the, you know, the acting had an unreal quality about it too. You know, less so the lead, what is her name again?
Moira Shearer as Victoria
Moira Shearer.
Page,
Yes. You know, she was probably the most naturalistic out of the cast, but there was a lot of high drama, I thought from everyone surrounding her, you know. And I think, you know, having seen other movies that this pair has done and seen that, you know, most of them have pretty, you know, for the, at least the time, naturalistic acting, I had to think that that was on purpose. You know, there's a reason why, particularly, I don't know if you noticed this, but it seems as if the drama is very slowly amped up as the movie goes on.
Like the acting. It's almost like there's no, I mean, just as far as the plot goes, it takes a long time to get to where there's like any real like big drama happening. Like we get really introduced to these people, get a sense of who they are. And then like the love story actually happens, and it's kind of a surprise. It's like suddenly, oh, they've been in love for a while. And then like really after that ballet sequence, the last 30 minutes is like very high drama. And yeah, I think you're right. The performance is kind of ratchet up too. But before that, it's pretty low key is not the right word, but it's definitely more calm as things go on. And then it gets really, really wild at the end.
I mean, it's just, you almost don't see it coming the way it ratchets the way
it amps up quickly. I don't know
the way, you know, Nurse Ratchet it
nurse
up.
Ratchets it up. Yes. Nurse Ratchet shows up. That's an unexpected twist.
Didn't see that twist coming. You know, suddenly Louise Fletcher's there and I'm like, why? I thought she wouldn't have been born yet. And anyway,
anyway, go on.
Jack Nicholson's there. You're like, I didn't
What's happening.
But no, I, yeah, I think it feels like, it feels like there's a rising line of tension, but after the ballet sequence, it's like the movie knows at that point in time it has the permission to be a little bit more erratic. And so then the reality becomes more surreal. As well as the story itself.
And it kind of leads up to an ending that really kind of leads into the surrealness of it. And the ending, which I guess we can not spoil the very end, but it's pretty remarkable, like stylistically and everything. The shoes play into it in a big way. And that there's like a really interesting visual involving the shoes at the very end of the film. But yeah.
Go ahead. Yes, there is. And it's stunning.
It was,
I mean, like, and the and the metaphor comes full circle.
Mm-hmm.
Too. So
yes, absolutely. And it's something like, so as it kind of continued on, I was kind of seeing where it was going as far as like she's being torn between these two worlds. So I almost, you know, knew what was going to happen at the end or had an idea, but the way it's executed was so stunning still, like even knowing, like, I think this is going to happen, but the way it's executed is really amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Just, this is actually a really good movie, guys. You should maybe go, you should maybe go see it. I know that this is a really original,
original thought.
Statement. No one's ever talked about this movie ever before.
Well, what about the other actors here? So Anton Walbrook plays Mr. Lermontov. What else is he known for?
I don't know.
I'll pull up IMDb here. He was in Life and Death of Colonel Blimp as well. He's in Gaslight.
Oh, yes.
Vaguely familiar with Gaslight. That's what he's known for.
Is it the 1940 Gaslight?
Correct, yes.
That, you see, Gaslight's an interesting one because it was first made in the UK, and then they made an American version after.
It wasn't the American version is a Hitchcock thing? Well, I guess it wouldn't be the American version then. Sorry.
It is it is George Cukor. But it stars Ingrid Bergman and Charles Boyer, and it is it's a wonderful little movie, but it is not the same thing as what that guy stars in.
Gotcha.
But it is where the term gaslighting comes from.
Yeah, which is, you know, still very relevant, obviously. The other lead here is Marius Goring as Julian Craster. He's also known for Stairway to Heaven, which again was I guess that's A Matter of Life and Death, the alternate title there. It's listed here, Stairway to Heaven on IMDb. Barefoot Contessa, The Scarlet Pimpernel, so several credits, 103 credits actually on IMDb, so quite a career.
Or just 103? Oh, goodness.
But this is his biggest by far, I think. And he's solid in this. I think he's a good actor.
Yeah, I mean, the whole cast is pretty good in this. It's and I wasn't trying to disparage them by talking about the dramatics of the cast.
Right,
I think
right.
It's on purpose. So that's why it's just a really interesting choice.
Yeah. The introduction to Julian is really interesting. So it opens with basically the ballet that's this company's ballet before The Red Shoes, or maybe two before, I can't remember. But he is a student, and his professor is the composer for the ballet. So he comes to see it and realizes as the show goes on, like, his professor has completely plagiarized his work, and he's listening to this ballet. He's like, this is my music. And he gets very upset about this, goes to see Mr. Lermontov about it. And the conversation they have is really fascinating. Mr. Lermontov like says that he believes him, that this is his work. And he says something about it's much harder to feel the need to steal than to be stolen from. And so kind of empathizes with this guy who's stolen the work, but then then hires Julian to replace him, essentially. And I thought it was a really interesting kind of way to bring him into the story. Yeah,
it was. I agree. Well, I mean, like that whole introductory section in the when they're there watching the performance is such an interesting way to introduce the characters, I thought.
And then there's like an after party, and that's where we meet, where we see Victoria at the show, but then we kind of get to know her at this after party. Her aunt is throwing this party and has invited everyone that's involved in the show. Really wants her to dance for Mr. Lermontov to kind of like audition, and he's like, this is a party, this is not an audition. He gets very mad about it. They have an interesting conversation too. And the one part that I really like, let's see. He says, why do you want to dance? And she says, why do you want to live? I said, well, I don't know exactly why, but I must. And so that's my answer too. I thought it was a cool. So yeah, I think maybe that's what you were getting at earlier, is like, it kind of applies to other, like kind of the artistic drive in general, like not just maybe dancing or ballet, but it kind of gets at that in kind of a cool way. And that's can kind of be what the Red Shoes are standing in for in a way, depending on how you read it. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, it's well, I mean, I think that the movie is trying to say that, you know, art is life in a way, you know,
which,
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say that that's a valuable thing even for me personally, because I think art was sometimes devalued. I mean, our society devalues it all the time. And like art programs get cut, funded cut and all that kind of thing. And, but yeah, like I didn't see being an artist as like a legitimate career in some way. And I still am wrestling with that. Like, oh no, art's a really important part of the human experience, and kind of the drive to be creative is like, it's a really important thing. So anyway, it kind of spoke to me in that way too, about kind of the drive to creativity. Although, you know, it's messy in this movie because she gets really, you know, caught in between their creative drive it's almost like work-life balance is one way you can look at it or something. But I don't know. It's an interesting I think there's a lot of different ways you can look at it and kind of reflect on it. But just like anything, you can bring your own experience to it and have kind of a personal experience with it. But anyway.
Yeah, no, that's it. Exactly. This is the reason why it is, I think, a work of art, is because you could pull from this, is it about that work-life balance? Is it about the way that men treat women? Is it about sacrificing life for art? It ultimately, I don't think, is about any of those one things. The thing about great art is you're able to draw from it whatever you're feeling in that moment, in a way.
Speaking about the treatment of women, that just made me think too of a comparison. I couldn't help but think about like Marilyn Monroe and like stories like that, where a person is promised stardom and then things there's maybe nefarious intentions there, or you know, it's not what you, if you get what you wished for, it's not what you always, you know, it can end up being a bad thing, kind of thing. Because she's kind of groomed for being a star, like, oh, you're going to be the lead for this company for, you know, years, and you'll be famous overnight, and like all this stuff. And it doesn't go great for her in the end.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. And the shoes themselves become the very obvious stand-in for that temptation, you know.
But it's
just interesting, like, what is that saying, you know?
Yeah.
And that's where, is it saying that great art can't come without the sacrifice of some of yourself?
Yeah,
you know. Interestingly, post Red Shoes, you know, Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, it wasn't their last collaboration. I don't remember which movie that is. They make a couple other things for independent studios, for different studios, I should say, in the 50s. But Michael Powell does go on to make a really great movie called Peeping Tom in 1960, which is kind of like another one of those early horror movies that kind of really influences that genre. And she's actually in that. Vicky, the woman, Moira.
Shear.
For some reason, I think that the existence of Schitt's Creek is ruining her name.
The word Moira. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's funny.
But she's also in that as well. She doesn't make very many movies, and most of them are dance films, but she is in that movie. Then he, Michael Powell, later ends up marrying Thelma Schumacher. Thelma.
Yes, Thelma.
who is, of course, Martin Scorsese's editor. He's not the only person she's edited for, but she always works with Martin Scorsese, and they had a relationship at the end of his life, and she has since become quite an advocate for the restoration and appreciation of the Powell and Pressburger films. And of course, Martin Scorsese, her often collaborator, considers The Red Shoes to be one of, if not the best, I think he names this in a movie called The River, the two greatest Technicolor films. And Black Narcissus is one of his favorite horror movies. So he is a big fan of their work, and he uses somebody who is very closely connected to Michael Powell as one of his frequent collaborators to this day.
How cool that is. He's on the, so Martin Scorsese does some restoration work. I'm not sure exactly in what capacity with Criterion, actually. He's like, and he helps curate some stuff for them too. But he, on the Red Shoes DVD, there's a little special about the restoration process, and he kind of narrates it and talks through what's going on. And it's with Technicolor prints, it's, you know, kind of even more complicated to restore, because you have to restore three different reels of it. And it shows kind of the different issues they run into and how they correct those. It's pretty interesting little featurette. And I've seen stuff like that before, but not about a Technicolor movie. So it's kind of an interesting little thing. I wonder if that's on YouTube or something. I'll see if I can find it and link it, but it's on the Criterion edition of The Red Shoes.
The restoration process of those movies can be super, super complicated, because with the three strips, the key is aligning them together. And if the original negatives don't exist, then you can't realign the prints. And so things, when they are not, when the three different strips are not perfectly in sync with one another, the image will look slightly blurred because things are not in sync. But when you get a properly restored Technicolor print where everything is in alignment and none of the strips have warped over time, or that has been corrected, oftentimes it has to be corrected digitally, you end up with a picture, as with this restoration that is gorgeous on HBO Max of The Red Shoes, you end up with a picture that is about better than anything else you're ever going to see anywhere.
Yeah, that's where I watched it as well. Was actually, I got the DVD, but I was like, actually, HBO Max is a little nicer quality on my TV. So I watched that version of it, and it looks great. So that's available to stream on HBO. I think it's also on Criterion Channel, if you subscribe to that one. But yeah.
Yes, it is. Criterion is one of the reasons why this movie has been so in the public consciousness, because they include it in their collection. And it really does make a difference when Criterion highlights films. I think it brings it into the conversation in a way, because it's so respected amongst film aficionados.
Speaking of which, if you're listening to this, you know, pretty soon after we put it out, it right now is July, which is the half off all Criterions at Barnes & Noble. I've already spent some money there, more than I meant to spend at the Barnes & Noble, grabbing some things. So, yes, if you're into that, now is the time to go stock up.
You might have heard a cat meowing. I'm very sorry.
That's okay.
It's an occupational hazard. Of being a cat daddy. Go buy some, go support Criterion. They do the work for people who like things like we do.
Yes, very much so. Like, seriously, if you're into movies and you for a while, I just would buy whatever cheap DVD copies of things back in college. But then I was like, I think I want to curate this and have a little bit. I don't have a huge collection or anything, but I have several Criterion editions, just because they do such wonderful work on really, they really respect the art, and I don't know, they're great. I really like it. Well, is there anything else we need to say about The Red Shoes today?
I mean, I think we covered it. I think everything else people just have to discover by watching.
If you haven't watched it, go watch it. You will not regret it. And that kind of wraps up our Technicolor marathon. I'm so glad that we kind of dove into this, because it is such an interesting and important part of cinema history. And I think it's been a good way to focus in on, one aspect of movies back in the day, and looking at classic classic cinema. So thank you, Rance, for helping select these and helping talk through them. I think it's been a really good, a good little marathon.
I loved it. I invite me back anytime.
Yes, yes, of course. I will definitely do that. We'll find another angle to look at some classics some months down the road here and go from there. But all right, well, I guess we can say bye-bye for now, Rance. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Talk to you soon.
Huge thanks to Rance for this marathon and for today's discussion. I couldn't do this without him, and I love picking his brain about classic films like this. So big, big thanks, Rance. Coming up on the podcast, we've got a new marathon coming, and that is going to be looking at the world of Wong Kar-wai. So Criterion, the prestigious film distribution company that puts out really beautiful editions of a lot of classic films and modern films, have a handful of box sets as well, and recently released a 7-film box set of Wong Kar-wai's films. If you're unfamiliar with him, he's directed some absolute incredible films like Chungking Express, In the Mood for Love, and many others. We are going to dive into all 7 films over the next 6 episodes, so we'll double up in one episode. And Omaya Jones is going to be back. He was on the podcast a lot last year when we looked at contemporary Asian filmmakers, so I'm so glad to have him back again and break down this box set. We'll talk about a lot of the supplements, I'm sure. So if you have the Criterion box set, this will be a great thing to kind of watch along, hopefully, and listen to some outside perspectives and bring some context in. Really excited to watch these because I've only seen one Wong Kar-wai film before. So this is going to be a journey for me, and I'm excited to dig into them all. So tune in for that next time. We'll also have a review of something new. Not exactly sure what that will be just yet, but excited to start out this new marathon. And with that, thank you for listening to Arthouse Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes now, and you can listen to all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. You can learn more at appallingproductions.com or find a link in the show notes. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, you can leave a rating or review in your podcast app, or you can buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter by going to arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening, and until next time, keep it snob free.